Hi, this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence. Sounds egotistical, but the intelligence comes from my guest, in this case, Jeff Adachi, who is the elected public defender of San Francisco, which is unusual. I think you're the only elected one in the state. Public defenders are the people who defend the public when they get in trouble. The original reason for scheduling this interview was that Jerry Brown, our governor in California here, has just signed a no-cash bail bill in August. For someone like myself, the idea of not having, whether you wait in jail for your trial or out, you know, and having it based on a cash bail sounded like a good thing. And I gather it sounded like a good thing to you at first. And then you came out strongly against it. And it is now law in California, right?
Right. Yeah. Governor signed it last week.
So what about, why this about face on your part?
Well, you know, I've been a public defender for 30 years. And one of the fundamental contradictions of our judicial system is this idea that you pay your way out of jail. And the way it works now is that if you're charged with a crime, even a misdemeanor crime, the judge will look at you and decide whether or not you should go free or not. If they decide to keep you in jail, they'll set what's called a bail, which is amount of money, which if you post, you can buy your freedom, which seems to run counter to the idea of justice and liberty for all. Because if you have money, Bernie Madoff was able to buy his freedom pending his trial. Why? Because he could put up the millions of dollars that he had to, yet you have people who can't post $1,000 who are in jail. 85% of the people who are behind bars, as we speak, are there because they cannot afford to post bail. In other words, they have not been convicted of a crime yet. And so bail reform, which has already taken hold in places like New Jersey, Kentucky, Indiana, even some of the southern states like Kentucky, was supposed to happen here in California. And there was a bill that was introduced that we all supported that would have used what's called a risk assessment, an objective risk assessment to determine who should be released. And in most cases, people would have been released, except for the most serious cases. In those cases, the government would have to show that there was a reason to detain you. However, the governor and the judiciary said, oh, we're going to work on this bail reform bill and come up with something agreeable. We didn't hear anything for 8 months. And then just a month ago, they suddenly released this bill that completely changes the basic principles of what we set out to do and instead gives all the power to the judges. That's part of what we were trying to avoid in the first place, because under the bail system, judges would set high bails, which they knew people couldn't meet. We're concerned that under this new bill, they're going to use this. It's called preventive detention, which means that a judge can order you jailed without setting any bail indefinitely, even on misdemeanor cases.
And I'm interested in this word preventive, because we also have preventive policing now. And the conceit of this idea is that somehow computer technology and all of the information we have on people allow you to construct a profile, which will then predict whether they'll commit a crime or whether they'll jump bail or so forth. And there are privately owned companies like Palantir and others that are providing this data analysis to police departments and others throughout the country. We're kind of mesmerized by this technology. And yet there are quite a few studies already that show this preventive policing and now preventive bail on the basis of computer analysis is deeply flawed and biased racially and otherwise. Is that not the nub of the issue here?
Well, these sort of data-based analyses of figuring out who should be released, there is merit to that because they look at more objective factors. We had a situation recently where a judge agreed to let out a gentleman. And when the person came out in court, he's a large African-American man. The judge says, I'm not letting him out. And my attorney said, well, the only thing that's changed since you agreed to let him out is that you see he's a large African-American man. And the judge said, are you calling me a racist? And my attorney said, yes. Well, That's what I got called. But, I mean, those kinds of situations are not unusual where you have judges who are making decisions on facts other than objective criteria. So these formulas and algorithms that they use do have some merit, but they have to be tracked very carefully. It's not something that you can let go. And the other problem is that, yeah, when you start making decisions on what you think a person may do, I mean, it's true. If you let somebody out, they might do a bad thing. That's always a possibility. But it's like the Philip Dick's books, Minority Report, where police go out and arrest people based on what they're going to do in the future. You can't do that as a fair and democratic society. So what we believe is that these formulas and algorithms have their place, but they have to be tracked very carefully. We've been using them in San Francisco. This investor, John Arnold, came up with this algorithm through his foundation. They've been using it around the country, and they use like 10 basic factors to figure out who to let out of jail. Things like how many times you've failed to show up for court before and other objective factors. That's a good indicator of whether a person will show up again. So we do support the use of these algorithms, but you have to track them very carefully.
So your basic beef here in California, I don't want to take up all our time on this, is just the messed up what could have been a good bill and gave too much power to the judges, and now right. It's a bad bill, right?
Some people say, well, why don't you trust judges to make these decisions? Well, it's because judges, like any other human being, make mistakes. And we see this really as a power grab where they're trying to design, implement, and score the system. And we know that's usually against people of color and poor people. So we're going to be litigating these issues in court. We have the big case that's going to be heard in the California Supreme Court, the Humphrey case. Keep tuned.
Okay. So just before we move off criminal justice, which is really in some ways the most obvious failing of our society, because we have, if you look at the racial composition of the jailed and the incarcerated and within the criminal justice system population, it's a repudiation of the whole civil rights movement. It's startling. We don't talk about it very much.
Even in San Francisco, which is a progressive bastion, you have African Americans being arrested at 7 times the rate of their white counterparts. And for crimes like drug offenses, which we know that whites use, abuse, and sell drugs more than blacks do. Again, this problem of how people are treated differently. And with Black Lives Matter and the unjustified shooting of black and brown people, we've seen a renaissance. I mean, this has always been a problem. But for someone that's been a public defender for 30 years to see these issues of reform against mass incarceration finally being embraced by mainstream is such a great thing. And we're talking about reform in California like we never have before. People care about these issues, and you have the celebrities, Jay-Z and John Legend, getting involved. And I'm on the board of this one organization called the Quattrone Center Criminal Justice Reform. John Legend just joined our board. I mean, that's a big deal. And so when you have spokespeople for a movement that is not only promising but delivering real change, it really is at that tipping point. I'm very excited about that, but we have a long way to go. And these issues are very complex. We still have disproportionate. There are almost 2.5 million people who are in prison and jails in this country, and half are black. That's more black people than were enslaved. If you look at all the numbers, enslaved. I mean, that's a huge number. We have 2.5 million children in this country who have parents who are in jail, and most for nonviolent offenses. In terms of where we are in criminal justice reform, we're right at the beginning of, I hope, will be a sustained revolution. And as you point out, many of the issues in the civil rights movement are at the core of criminal justice reform today.
I'm talking to Jeff Adichie, and who is the elected, that's important to mention, elected public defender here in San Francisco. And San Francisco now is a very strange community of gentrification, of privilege. The San Francisco I knew when I first arrived here to go graduate school in Berkeley back in 1959 actually had a very strong black community in Oakland and San Francisco. people who come north to work in the defense industry, longshoremen, good college opportunities and so forth, and people like Willie Brown, who became mayor, who had come from Mineola, Texas, and so forth. Now it's getting to be rare to see a black person able to live in the city, and yet there's resentment of some black athletes here in San Francisco, particularly Colin Kaepernick, most famously, registering unhappiness with the state of the nation in many ways. In fact, just this last Sunday, one football player had a T-shirt on your issue of opposing cash bail bonds. It's interesting because you can be a privileged athlete, and that's one route. People say, wow, what do you mean we don't have prejudice in America? Look, 70-80% of the people in the National Football League with high salaries are black. But yet we're getting protests from black athletes who do make a lot of money saying, no, when we're stopped or our children are stopped or something, they are racially profiled. They are not treated in a fair way. And you're kind of at the center of this right here. You see the reality, don't you?
As a public defender, my job is to ensure that people's constitutional rights are respected. But I really see public defenders playing a larger role. Colin Kaepernick, you mentioned him, and I'm glad that Nike has made him sort of their spokesperson. That's a really bold move. But he started an organization called Know Your Rights. And that's actually right up the alley of what public defenders do. Because when you talk about the basic constitutional rights of this country, and if you go back and look at the Bill of Rights, right, when they passed the Constitution, there was a large dissent who were unhappy with the amount of power that the government got. And so they came up with the Bill of Rights and said, no, we're going to protect the free press, and we're going to protect the right to be free of unreasonable search and seizure and have a right to counsel. And that's where public defenders come from. I really see the role of public defenders as really like guardians of the justice system. Because I'm elected, I can't be fired. And I've been able to go after police misconduct, prosecutorial misconduct. I just filed a motion in a murder case I'm handling against a prosecutor who's now being prosecuted by the state bar for hiding evidence. We had an investigation a few years ago where the police were breaking into people's rooms without warrants. Judges refused to believe that when we would bring it in motions. Well, one of my investigators went back to that place where this was happening. It was at the Henry Hotel in San Francisco. And we downloaded a year and a half worth of video. And it showed that in every case where the police were making arrests there, that they were breaking into people's rooms without warrants and stealing from them. And as a result, seven police officers were indicted based on the evidence we produced. Now, who would think of a public defender's office doing that? We had the biggest crime lab scandal where over 1,000 cases were dismissed because a crime lab technician was stealing drugs from the lab. The role of the public defender, as I see it, is to protect the rights of citizens, but also to watch out for errant judges and prosecutors who are hiding evidence and police who are violating the law. My hope is that public defenders will embrace that role, but the reality is that most places public defender offices are very poorly funded. You've probably seen some of the exposés about New Orleans public defenders and what happens there. So again, it's a tough job when you don't have the resources to do what you need to do.
Let me let people in on why I wanted to do this interview. I do think the bail bonds issue is really important. And I look at your biography and I think, wow, you know, your parents were in an internment camp in Arkansas during the war, right?
Yeah.
Great War.
Was in Arkansas.
And so now when we have all these abstract discussions about immigration, you know about racial profiling, you know about discrimination, you know about challenging people's patriotism, and you actually in your public defender work now have a unit to protect undocumented people and extend rights to them.
I'm Japanese American, so my parents and grandparents were in the internment camps during World War II with 120,000 other Japanese Americans. And I'm embarrassed. I didn't find out about it till I was in third grade because nobody talked about it. I got in a fight with another kid who said, oh, your parents were in jail. And I'm like, no, they weren't. And I went home and I asked my mom about it. And she said, yeah, you know, we were in. And I said, well, what did you do? She said, well, we were Japanese Americans. And they had not even been to Japan. I'm fourth generation Japanese American. They were in these camps for 4 years. It pretty much destroyed their lives. They lost everything and had to rebuild their lives. That experience, learning about what happened to them, that they didn't have a trial, there was never any Japanese American who was charged with espionage. And you mentioned Fred Korematsu. He was one that stood up to the internment order. He went to prison. That experience, I think, really ingrained in me the notion that you have to fight for your rights. It's not something that you can take for granted. They experienced that. Being a public defender was something I never even imagined, not even being a lawyer. I didn't grow up knowing any lawyers. My dad was an auto mechanic. I definitely grew up on the other side of the tracks. I wasn't a good student. But at some point, I had the spark in me that said, you know what? I think I do want to go to college. And then I became involved in a case of a San Francisco man who was wrongfully convicted of murder, was on death row. And I worked on his case for 4 years, not as a lawyer, but just as a activist, I guess, trying to raise consciousness about his case. And we succeeded in getting his conviction overturned. And they decided to retry him in San Francisco 9 years after he had been convicted. And I was in court when he was found not guilty. Tony Serra, a very well-known lawyer here in San Francisco, took his case for free and won his case. And that really cemented my desire to want to be a public defender, along with my parents' experience.
Let's segue into this question of immigrant bashing, because obviously it didn't begin with Donald Trump and the scapegoating of the most vulnerable people in the society, people who have questionable or don't have papers. This is an old story, and it'd be convenient to think this is just something new, but we kind of turned our back on it historically. And as long as it's not in the spotlight, oh, we can have all these undocumented people and so forth. And really, Trump has shown us that we have a problem here that Democrats and Republicans, right down through the whole, certainly post-war period, but really going back before to the Chinese Exclusion Acts and everything, that as a country, we've never really dealt with in a serious, humane way.
If you look back historically, you'll see that this whole immigration debate is nothing new. Immigrants have been used as a scapegoat. You can look at the Chinese, Japanese, Irish people for a long time were considered undesirables. There were laws as far back as the 1930s that discriminated against European Jews, for example. But what I've tried to do with this most recent effort is to replicate what they're already doing in New York. Most people don't realize that in the immigration courts, you don't have a right to a lawyer, even if you're a child. And you have these immigration courts, you have a judge, you have a prosecutor from ICE, the immigration authorities, and then you have no one at the defense table. And then the detainee, the immigrant, appears on closed circuit TV. So it's almost like something out of a strange novel where you're saying, wait a minute, this is not how justice is supposed to work. But what I've been working on for the past 2 years, I've gotten support, is to have a immigration unit in the public defender's office that provides representation to any immigrant who is detained, who's in custody. And New York already does this. So we're trying to push this idea on the West Coast. Alameda has public defender's office has a unit, and we do as well. And we're representing now about a third of the people who are in the immigration courts. Because if you are deported from this country, and we're not only talking about undocumented, I mean, these are also people who are green card holders who are non-citizens. You can be killed. You can face persecution in your country of origin. So what we try to do is make sure that people's rights, at least they know their rights, and they have an attorney that they consult with. And I think most Americans support that idea.
So we're going to take a break for a minute, and I'll be back with the elected public defender. That means he's accountable to the people and not just the politician. Appointed him, Jeff Adichie. We'll be back. We're back with Jeff Adichie, the elected public defender of San Francisco. So let me ask you this question about the criminal justice system and honesty and so forth. What have you learned about how the system operates and where is truth?
The thing that most people would be surprised to find out is that once you're in the system, once you're under arrest, the entire government turns against you. And unless you have a high-priced lawyer, you're going to have to rely on the public defender. Is that public defender going to be able to do what needs to be done in order to represent you properly? Because if not, you're going to get lost in the crowd. You're just one little voice. There might be a million people out there crying out for justice. Why do you get justice. Now, if you happen to get convicted, and there is a lot of wrongful conviction in this country, they say probably 5% of cases that go to trial could even be even greater. We see a lot of cases that are thrown out, lack of evidence, overcharging is rampant. But even if you assumed that 5% of the people in this country were wrongfully convicted, that's a huge number of people. Because we have, what, over 2 million people who are in jail or prison. Look at the people who have been convicted of death penalty offenses. These are cases where the most amount of resources are put into those cases. And we've had, what, hundreds of people who have been exonerated from death row. Now, this is not to say that we have the worst system in the world. I think our American justice system is pretty good. But when you look at the impact of racism, of overfunding of law enforcement and underfunding of public defense, do you know out of every dollar that's spent on law enforcement and prosecution, only 5 cents goes to public defense? I've talked to public defenders in the South, for example, that have caseloads of 500 to 1,000 people at a time. I mean, how can you possibly represent people? In my office, we have caseload standards, so they only handle a certain number of cases. But if you go to most places, public defense is very poorly resourced and funded. We need to change that in this country. If we want people to have real constitutional rights, if those rights are going to mean something substantively to people, we have to make sure that public defenders are properly funded.
So let me ask you this, because you've been part of a group that has been considered disposable, unpatriotic by virtue of ethnicity, skin color, the Japanese. Then you celebrate it as brilliant, becomes a whole different stereotyping experience. It seems to me at the core of this is there's a view of disposable people and that it's informed in a racist manner, because you, the statistic, how many people are in jail that 50% are black? But it's really, how do we accommodate? It's like the question about the Japanese or the Chinese Exclusion Act. How did we accommodate that a Chinese-American person could not get married in California until 1943? It's amazing, the total denial.
Japanese couldn't own land until the 1950s, couldn't become lawyers. There were a lot of prohibitions that were against particularly Japanese immigrants. The reality is that we've always had certain groups that become the focus of our dissatisfaction, our disdainment, scapegoating. It's just that that's changed over the years. You just have another person that kind of is the next person in line. We have to stop that. America at its best is a place where everyone is welcome, where everyone who wants to be part of this great society is able to do that. And we strayed from that to the point now where we're looking at fellow Americans saying, oh, you don't belong here.
Something you just said really drives me nuts, and I'm not blaming you for this, that you grew up poor and black in Oakland or brown. You didn't have anything like kind of an equal playing field. You had lousy schools.
Still like that now.
Exactly, yeah. My point. And yet we have this fiction that somehow we cared about people. We cared about people when we need them, but we seem to have the ability, and you as a Japanese child, fourth generation, fifth generation, should know this. I hadn't mentioned Fred Korematsu. I did before we started talking. Yeah. This is a guy who is just a normal American, blah, blah, war comes along, and he says, no, you don't have the right to put me in a concentration camp. What did I do? He takes his case to all the way to the Supreme Court and loses. So we accepted that. And
although it was reversed, right? This attorney, Dale Minami from San Francisco, brought his case back with the team, and they were able to get his conviction.
Yeah, how many years later?
40-odd years later.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is, and particularly in relation, when you, the statistic you throw out, 50% of this prison population is black. I mean, you just know that that's wrong. It's so wrong on so many levels of opportunity, of schools, of role model. You could go down the list. And basically, yes, we like to think that we have the greatest justice system and we're very inclusive and blah, 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 but we're a nation that was conceived in slavery, has treated people terribly that came to destroy. And maybe it's time to cut through this nice, gauzy image and say 50% of the people in what we are now the largest imprisoned population in absolute terms, aren't we?
Yeah, in the whole world. In California, as a state, has the highest incarceration rate per capita than anywhere else in the world.
And yet we think this is an enlightened progressive state. This isn't the Deep South or anything. How do your colleagues, now you've gone some to the best law school, you've gone, you know, came through UC system and everything, you rub shoulders, you dealing business with well-educated, in the most affluent, one of the most affluent, per capita affluent communities in the world, San Francisco. How do they live with this idea that half of our prison population is made up of black people?
Well, that's, I think, the question people need to ask themselves. We ask ourselves that question every day, but we fight injustice in specific cases. You know, what is just in one space and time and place is different than what another person might seem is just. But at the end of the day, you know whether or not you've been at the short end of the stick of justice. Our job as public defenders is to figure out what is just for this particular person given the situation that he or she is in. I just had a case reversed last week where my client, I felt, should not have gone to prison. He got 83 years in prison. He turned down a 12-year deal to go to trial. And then after trial, he gets 83 years. Now, that's a huge differential there. We spent 4 years fighting his case, and a good friend of mine, John Kecker, who owns a big law firm here in San Francisco, came in and took his case and won it, and won it on appeal, and now we're going to retry it. So for that client to be relieved of an 83-year sentence, but what about all the people that weren't? What about all the people who didn't even have money to get an appellate lawyer? You think about that, and you realize that justice is so relevant today to everything that we do. And that's why people care about justice. And I think so long as people care about it, the fact that injustice exists, it's always going to be there in some way, shape, or form. I breathe injustice when I wake up in the morning. It sounds like you do too. And you take in the stories and you feel empathy and you want to do something about it. I'm lucky that I have a job where I can do something about it every day for somebody, whether it's making a phone call, whether it's helping somebody get their record cleared, whether it's, you know, making sure that people are properly represented in court. It's a job I take seriously, and it can be life or death. And people don't realize how important your basic constitutional rights are until you lose them, until you suffer injustice. That's the message that I would leave people with, is that find something that you care about and then do something about it.
Thank you, Jeff Adachi.
It's an honor and pleasure.
And those are words to live by and be consistent to. I want to thank Josh Scheer and Isabel Carrion for being our producers, Kat Yor and Mario Diaz at KCRW for being great engineers. And here at Sports Byline in San Francisco, Darren Peck has come through for us once again. Thank you, Darren. See you next week for another edition of Sheer Intelligence.